Hello, I'm Bobby Osinski, and you're listening to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. This is the show about music, the music business, recording, and production. And today's special guest is Tom Kozik, who's the COO, or the Chief Operating Officer, of Omnia Media, which is a multi-channel YouTube network. And he's going to be talking about how musicians can be making money on YouTube. And also, Tom comes from the gaming industry, and he knows it really well. So he'll be talking about that as well, making money with your music in gaming. But first, let's get to the news here. I don't know if you've been paying attention, but there's a lot going on in the streaming world lately, streaming music world. Samsung came out with a new service that they call Milk Music. Yes, milk, like drink milk. And then Apple is talking about coming out with their own streaming service, and they've been talking to all of the various record labels about that, because they have to get a new license if they do. What they use for iTunes or iTunes Radio won't cover streaming. And Amazon, there's rumors about Amazon also starting their own streaming service. And there's been rumors about Google's YouTube doing their own streaming service for quite some time. Actually, we thought it was going to be out at the end of the year, but we're still waiting on that one. And of course, Beats Music just came out a couple months ago. And yet one other, there's Deezer, which is a really big streaming service in Europe, and they're also talking about coming to the United States. So we're going to have a lot more choices in streaming music pretty soon, and this is good for the music business. This is good for you as musicians, as songwriters, as producers, as people trying to make some money in the business. And the reason why we're seeing that the music business is changing very rapidly from downloads to streaming. And the reason why is once people begin to stream, they immediately see why it's so cool. It's called the access model. It's what, you know, officially everybody calls this. And the reason why is you can have access to all the music you want. 10 million plus, and actually most of them are over 20 million songs that you can access anytime and any place. Now, if you think about it, why would you spend $10 a month, let's say, on 10 downloads from iTunes or Amazon MP3 or any of their competitors, while you can spend zero or $5 or $10 or not that much more than that and get millions of songs at your fingertips anywhere? As soon as people see that, or hear that, it makes a big difference in their lives. The other thing that happens, the first time you fill up a hard drive with all of your songs, with your library, and you start to run out of room and you realize that your library is 30 gigs or 40 gigs large, then you begin to see the value of streaming, where you don't have to worry about that. You don't have to worry about the hard drive going down. You don't have to worry about backing it up. You don't have to worry about moving it to other devices that you have, although that's a whole lot easier with the various services, the locker services now. But you can see the value. Now, why this is good on a financial side is the fact that right now there's only 26 million music subscribers worldwide, and that's a drop in the bucket compared to the music users in the world. And what we're going to see is the more people that begin to pay for this service, the more money there's going to be in people's pockets as a result. So, I mean, you keep on hearing the horror stories of musicians saying, well, there's 3 million streams and all I got was $25. Well, there was actually a lot more money made than that. The fact of the matter is it didn't all trickle down to you. But when you begin to think that we're just really the tip of the iceberg of people that are streaming, if you multiply that by 10 or so, which is really within the realm of reason, not too much longer, you're going to see that all of a sudden there's going to be a lot more money, even though it's not that much, but it's coming from a lot of different places at the same time. And we're seeing this, for instance, in synchronization. Synchronization rights for your songs. So in other words, you write a song and you get it on a TV show. Well, the TV show doesn't pay all that much, but if you can get it across five TV shows across 200 networks, all of a sudden, it's paying a whole lot more. And you're finding people are doing this. They're getting their music on a lot of different places. And they're finding that suddenly that's becoming very lucrative. Well, streaming is pretty much the same thing. And you're going to see all of this take off within the next year. So this is a big deal, and it's worth really looking out for, because you're going to find that pretty soon it's going to be a big money maker, bigger than you think. The other big thing in the news is about Guitar Center. And if any of you have been following this, you know that Guitar Center's kind of a sad story in a way, because it's a story of financial engineering, a story that actually shouldn't be in the music business. What happened was Guitar Center was a really great store at one point in time. It was a place that you can go, and it was a supermarket for musical gear. It was great. And what ended up happening was they sold out. And the founders wanted to cash out. So they sold out to Bain Capital. And you might have heard of Bain Capital before, because they were owned once upon a time by Mitt Romney. Yes, that Mitt Romney that ran for president last year, or last a few years ago. And Bain Capital is a private equity company. And what they specialize in doing is buying a company, squeezing every last dime out of it, and then selling off all the parts. And that's how they make their money. And to do this, they usually don't put in all that much of their own money. They find other private equity funds to actually go in with them and take most of the burden. And this is what happened here. And now, here's the thing. The music industry is small. And it's so small that really there shouldn't be... We shouldn't have public companies, first of all, and we shouldn't have companies that are financially engineered like Guitar Center is right now. So anyway, they have a debt of over $1 billion. $1 billion. And last year, there was a big balloon payment that had to be paid. It's $650 million. And guess what? They couldn't do it. So they had to push it off into the future, and again, it cost them money. And what ended up happening was the main investor in all of this is called Ares Management. And after a while, Ares basically saw the writing on the wall and knew they weren't going to get their money out. So at least by just standing on the sidelines. So what they did was they went to Bain and they said, okay, now we're calling in our debt here and we're changing it to equity and we're going to run Guitar Center from now on. And this happened at the beginning of March. So those of us kind of in the inside of this that look at these things, you know, we all said, okay, this is it. This is the beginning of the end. And of course, what ended up happening was there's lots of denials. No, it'll never happen. It'll never happen. To make a long story short, Eric Garland, who's not only a musician, but he's an analyst. He analyzes companies, and he looks at future trends, future financial trends. He posted a number of really cogent looks at the whole Guitar Center, Bain Capital, Ares Management, financial engineering. And what you'll find is something that's closer to the way the mortgage industry went bad in 2008. They're using the exact same financial engineering that what happened to the mortgage industry. It's exactly the same type of things that are happening. So what's going to happen? Well, right now, probably nothing. You'll still be able to go to Guitar Center and you'll still be able to buy whatever you want. Although it's getting harder because they're actually stocking fewer and fewer items. And that's one of the problems, one of the things that starts to happen here. Everything starts to get squeezed. But you're going to see at some point in time, there's going to be some big changes at Guitar Center. And it may not be the same. There's either going to be stores that are sold or stores that are going to be closed. And sooner or later, you're going to find that the whole thing's going to implode. So if you like Guitar Center, that's great. Continue to buy there. If you don't, there's lots of other retailers out there that you can find. Mom and pop retailers are great, and I hope they come back, because you never get service like you get from a mom and top and pop retailer, although you may get a little bit, you may have to pay a little bit more, but it's worth it. But what I urge you to do is go to ericgarland.co. That's Eric, E-R-I-C, Garland, G-A-R-L-A-N-D, ericgarland.co. And he has a great blog. And again, most of it is financial analysis, but there's a couple of great articles on Guitar Center, and read what he says, because this is what he does for a living. He actually looks at the finances of companies and the health of companies. So don't take my word for it. Go and read what Eric has to say, and then make your own decision on what you think is going to happen. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll hear from my guest, Tom Kozik. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com or questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com, questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com, and we'll be right back. I'm here with Tom Kozik, who's not only one of the smartest guys I know, but an expert in so many fields. Prior to his job, his current job as a COO of Omnia Media, he was in the gaming industry for a long time, selling one of his companies to Yahoo, and then eventually making his way over to Atari as a VP of online gaming. So welcome, Tom. I'm glad you can be here today, and I know you're going to tell us a lot of stuff we didn't know before.
Well, I don't know about that. I'll try it, Bobby, but thank you for the kind introduction.
Let's start with MCNs. What is an MCN, and what does it mean to an artist or a band these days?
Well, an MCN stands for multi-channel network, and it's a business structure that Google had set up with YouTube to allow them really to offload a lot of the labor in many respects. It would enable them to create businesses that would aggregate and manage the rights for and oversee the relationships with hundreds and hundreds, if not tens of thousands, of individual artists who were putting content up on YouTube, be it music or video game content related, or nowadays you see a lot of style and beauty and fashion related content. But instead of, you know, literally millions of people trying to individually deal with Google on a one-to-one basis, they created the structure of multi-channel networks to aggregate content around various vertical categories. One of our strongest categories at Omnia is music. And we help manage the business relationships of those artists as it relates to their YouTube content.
So what are the benefits of an artist being involved with an MCN?
Probably from a musician standpoint, the first and foremost benefit is rights management. The MCNs, as granted the capabilities by our contractual relationship with YouTube, we have the ability to go out and help secure, manage the rights of artists' material up on YouTube. For musicians, what we're able to do is be able not only to take down illegal uploads of their content, but more importantly, for most independent artists, they're not so much worried in taking down other copies or uses of their music as much as they are making sure that their claim is laid to that content, and if there's any monetization, any ads running against it, that the artist is getting the revenue from that. So that's really the first line of defense and the first reason for being part of an MCN. Secondly, for those advertisements that do run against somebody's content, and again, advertisements on YouTube can be anything from the little banners you see across the bottom of the screen while you're watching a video, to a pre-roll commercial, to all the way to a brand integration where it's more of a product placement. But in those first two instances, whether it's a banner ad across the bottom or a pre-roll commercial, typically an MCN will be able to get the artist better rates than they would get if they were just sold as part of the overall YouTube platform sale. Google's got an amazing sales force, and they've got tremendous reach into all the agencies and media buyers and brands. But at the end of the day, they're selling bulk. They're selling just eyeballs in mass, whereas an MCN, because of specialization, we can sell a particular genre, a particular kind of artist, a particular kind of audience.
Well, who are you selling to then? Are you going to Google and saying, more or less isolate, your client base for this particular artist, or do you actually have a sales force that goes out to, the agencies or sponsors?
We have a sales force, and pretty much anybody who's an MCN has a sales force to one degree or another. If a brand like Toyota, the Scion brand has been doing a lot of great campaigns online recently. If Scion were to go to Google, they're going to ask for a bulk amount of viewers that fall into a certain age range, into a certain demographic mix. And, that may be great for one part of the campaign. Another part of their campaign, they may want to reach an urban audience or, a fan base that is interested in the hip-hop genre. Like, we have a large footprint in our market, in our network at Omnia, and where we'll take a campaign that's oriented specifically towards that audience and be able to get a better, not only higher value for the artist in terms of the advertising dollars, but we'll be able to get better engagement because we know which of those artists in our network get the most engagement on their videos with their fans.
Well, how are you determining that then? Is that just through the data that you're gathering from the views from YouTube or from Google?
Great question. A couple different ways, actually. So, YouTube provides a tremendous amount of data. That's no surprise to anybody, given the power that Google has behind it. But again, that's just raw data about the number of views on a video. What a multi-channel network should do for its artists, and it's something that all the big ones, ourselves included, do, is we then cross-reference that data with Facebook fan data about the people that are watching the videos, with Twitter data, Instagram data now, data across any number of different social connect points, and then look at which of the fans are most engaged. We do another level of analysis. Google provides some really great top-level metrics, but there's a lot deeper analysis you go into when looking at a particular artist. One of the things we watch for is the ratio between video views and subscriber count. So if you're an artist on YouTube, you're constantly asking for people to subscribe to your channel, and you're always putting up new content. We look at the ratios of the number of subscribers you have to the number of views against any given video, and the velocity with which you get those views. Yeah. So if you put up a new, and those, that data is buried there within the massive analytics you get from YouTube and from Google. But, if you're an artist, it's probably not your expertise in data analysis to be able to divine out those kind of answers. But I can tell you with pretty good certainty around any given campaign, which artists will get their videos watched most likely within the first few hours of posting.
Well, what's a good ratio then? What's a ratio that you would consider, something that has a good velocity and a ratio of views to subscribers?
Ratio numbers, we like to see numbers in the 70% range, where we know that 70% of your subscriber base, or a number equivalent to that, will view your video within the first 24 hours of it posted. That's just a powerhouse number. And if you're getting that kind of response, even if your audience is small, right? That's the key that I think a lot of artists miss, is they think they need to have these massive audiences, which of course everybody wants. But even if you've got a very small but dedicated audience, you're just as valuable.
Oh, you're looking at ratio a different way. See, I thought it was you have, let's say, 1 million views, so you should have 2 million subscribers as a result. And you're looking at it in terms of how many viewers will look at, how many of your subscribers will look at a given video, and that ratio. That's different.
Yeah, because we want to be able to see that, what is the power of your fan base, right?
Yeah.
It's any video can go viral, right? Something catches somebody's eye and suddenly everybody's passing around on social media. And you'll see often a lot of times that the video view numbers are well above a subscriber ratio. But those tend to be outliers, right? Those tend to be something unique that caught the public's eye. On a more consistent basis, we know you are a very good artist to work with on a consistent basis if a large percentage of your subscribers consume your new content right after you put it up. That means they're highly engaged, that they're really into you.
When you say right after, what's the time period?
We watch within 24 hours, within 3 days, and within 5 days. Those are the three thresholds. And actually, you know, it's funny you mentioned from my background, that's something that came out of the gaming industry, is looking at those next day, 3 day, and 5 day thresholds.
Well, what are the similarities then between what you're doing now in gaming? It sounds like they're very, very similar, really, when it comes to, you know, all the salient points of data and everything, right?
Well, yeah, there's a lot of crossover. As it relates specifically to musicians and music, there's two kinds of content that you see that work really well on YouTube from music artists. One, of course, is the performance itself, right? Whether that be a music video or a live performance, or even a recording with just lyrics or artwork on the screen in YouTube. You know, those, like, we classify as a performance because it's just the song itself. It's the music itself. There's other videos which are the behind the scenes videos, which are the review shows. You know, one of our artists is pretty well known for participating in a hip hop show for years called the Wake Up Show. And we're building a new show around these artists. So those kind of content where the audience is involved more in the creation of the music, involved more in the art itself, not just consumption of the song, those offer us a lot of opportunities to program them based on those audience dynamics. So the crossover for you there relates to the social gaming world of the last, say, 5 to 6 years, where you saw companies like Zynga and others create games based on the metrics of audience behavior. And so now we're actually able to start creating programming apart from the art, apart from the music, that is geared towards the metrics of audience behavior. That I know if I do a show with a particular collaboration of several different artists, I know the metrics of each of those artists, so I can predict with pretty good certainty what the metrics of consumption of that show will be, or that behind-the-scenes video will be.
So would you go to one of your artists, then, one of the artists assigned with Omni, and say... And make suggestions as to what you think would work in terms of videos?
Yeah, we actually have an entire team that's their job, is to work with them on coming up with ideas for new content apart from the music itself that will be sponsorable, will have a high degree of audience engagement, and will help move the needle. You know, I like to talk in terms of, you know, I do a lot of work with other startups as well, and one of the things that's always fun is to get away from the old traditional corporate mission statement that you know, so many people's eyes roll at. And you think about great companies like Google itself, right? Their company mantra is to organize the world's information and make it accessible. Right? The mantra is a very simple description of why it is you get out of bed in the morning and go do what you do. For us at Omnia, it is to make the artist's audience more valuable, period. That's exactly our entire business strategy in a nutshell. Whether that is to... grow the artist's audience in size, which increases its value, or to come up with different ways for the artist to engage with that audience, be it across YouTube, Instagram, selling merchandise directly to the audience through an online store. All of those grow the value of the audience you have. And conversely, of course, the more valuable we make an artist's audience, the more valuable that artist's audience is to an advertiser. So it helps everybody around the table.
Well, in our a previous conversation that we had, you were mentioning about tools that an MCN is able to offer that someone with their own individual YouTube channel just can't get. Can you describe some of those?
Right. So, you know, there's the basic tool that YouTube offers to a network such as ourselves is what's known as a CMS, a content management system. And it allows us to manage all the content that's actually in the network, as well as to look at the statistics and the data around any given video in the network. And so all that statistics we were talking about a moment ago are all part of what we can view through the CMS, the content management system. In addition to that, there's the rights management tools. Very few companies, the big record labels and the MCNs, such as ourselves, we all have access to what's known as the audio ID tool, which fingerprints an audio track and lets us do rights management and go find other people online who are incorporating your audio into their uploads on YouTube. So we can make those claims for you, either take them down or monetize them. The content ID tool does much the same, but for the video content. And, you know, there's a number of different small tool sets that an individual who's just uploading their content to YouTube, which hundreds of artists I discover a day are doing that, don't have access to those tools. They'll be able to get the basic statistics from their own YouTube dashboard, but they're not going to get the depth of these kind of tools that an MCN or a record label has access to.
What's the normal term with an artist or with any channel that they sign with the MCN?
Oh, I wish I could tell you there's something called normal. For a lot of us, to see a 70-30 or an 80-20 split on the net revenue, so to understand the economics a little bit, for every dollar that Google would take in advertising against somebody's video, they'll keep 45% of that. And that 55% then gets shared to the MCN. And the MCN typically has a contract with an artist ranging from 70-30 split to an 80-20 split to sometimes more advantageous splits, depending on the size and scale of the artist. We've got some pretty big names in our network now that have got splits that are very advantageous to them on the Google AdSense, the small banner ads side, mm-hmm. but they're more fair to the MCN for things that we do which require more effort, like merchandising or event management, those kind of things.
Well, speaking of revenue, so I keep on hearing about different revenue numbers per million,
mm-hmm.
and it's all over the place, and I think I understand why, but I think it'd be better to hear it from you. So with a million views on a monetized video, what could I expect to see?
A typical CPM, that's a cost per 1,000. That an artist should expect to see for music video or music related content should be close to $1.50. You may see less than that, but it should be getting up to about $1.50, and that's just for the basic advertising that Google's going to run on a video automatically. If you're able to do direct sales of brand integrations, you know, one of the ones I love, you know, the example I always like. Just because she's such a sweetheart and I enjoy her music, is Kina Granis, who from Orange County, California, who did a really cool brand integration a couple years ago with the Jelly Belly folks, the guys who make the jelly beans. And you know, those kind of deals can easily be in the high five, low six figures. That is then split between the production costs, the artist, and the MCN or agency who brought the deal to them.
Now, I'm hearing figures that are a lot higher than that, like may go, you know, as high as 8,000-9,000 per million.
On a per million basis, that's right. Yeah. No, I was talking about CPM. I was talking about a cost per 1,000.
Oh, got it. Okay.
Right.
Let's go to gaming. So, oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. No, and so the more lucrative money is always going to be on the brand integration side. The 8,000 per million that you're talking about, that's usually coming from pre-roll ads where there's a commercial in front of the video. My 50 number was oriented towards the AdSense banners across the bottom screen.
Now,
so it's a full spectrum.
That being said, though, isn't it relying on how long the viewer views the video and what the advertiser's actually paying, what the CPM they're paying? In terms of the money generated?
Right. So that's what I was saying. In the case of the AdSense banners across the bottom of the screen, that has a lot to do with how good of a job Google is doing at its bulk sales. Because an MCN such as ourselves is not going to go out and bother selling those. There's just not enough margin in it to make it worth our while. So we leave that to the Google machine. And a lot of that is self-serve and tends to be bid up in an online marketplace. So the price fluctuates a little bit between maybe you see it, you know, in the low months of the year, $1.10. Sometimes during the height of the Christmas buying season, you may see it $1.70, $1.75. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that's marketplace driven. The same is true, but in a lesser sense, in terms of the degree of fluctuation around those pre-roll video ads. And that's where you're getting the higher CPMs. But again, most of those are sold by Google directly. When we go do a brand integration deal for a Samsung or a L'Oreal or a Procter & Gamble even, the brand integrations are one pile of money that's split with the artist and any production costs that come out of it. But typically along with that is a media buy that includes some amount of pre-roll ads. If you think about it, obviously, if Samsung is sponsoring the video in some way and has some kind of product integration in the video, they want there to be a Samsung commercial running before you see it. So they'll go out and buy some media, and that typically is at a higher CPM because they're specifically saying, I want to buy a commercial in front of this video or in front of this artist's videos for a period of time.
Got it. Okay, let's talk about gaming for a second, which I know is a subject close to your heart. Boy, it's really changed for music and games over the last few years, hasn't it?
It has, but all for the better, I think.
Yeah, how so? How do you see it?
Well, I mean, you know, I think we all got excited. It was a lot of fun there to see the Rock Band era come and go, and a lot of people got excited about a new form of licensing revenue out of the video game world, but like anything else, games are a fad. And, you know, what was a cool game this year is obsolete next year. And so all those Rock Band style games were going to run their course. Guitar Hero, Rock Band, all the like. And, you know, so people that were all over Billboard and other magazines talking about the bright future of licensing weren't looking far enough into the future to recognize that, you know, again, gaming is a fashion and it comes and goes, different types of gaming. What, you know, I've talked about in the past, and, you know, we were seeing more and more of, and actually literally did a deal like this morning, where we have artists who are trying to get visibility on YouTube, and they're putting their content up on YouTube, musicians, making those same tracks available to the video game content creators on YouTube, who are not building games, they are simply putting up videos about video games. And that may sound to those listeners who aren't into video gaming or understand the nature of that business. The best way I like to describe it is if you walked into a store that sold video games as recently as even a few years ago, you'd see racks and racks of books on how to beat a particular video game, be it Halo or Call of Duty or whatever. That publishing industry disappeared overnight because of YouTube. So now if somebody's interested in how do they get past level 5 and Call of Duty Ghosts, so the fifth campaign, they'll go ahead and just go to YouTube and watch several videos of different celebrity gamers talking about how to get through that and how they played through it and what they did. And it's those gameplay videos are personality driven. They're incredibly engaging. But what's happening more and more over the last few years is those people who put up those gameplay videos put a soundtrack behind it. And so we're in an advantageous position of having both a really strong, about a little more than 300 plus music channels in our network, musicians, and a little more than 350 plus gaming channels in our network, that we can take music from our artists and put it behind the gameplay videos of our gamers.
Are you saying that they don't use the original music from the game then when they put it up, that they use something new?
Most of the time, the audio from the game itself is turned down fairly low because they're talking over it, but they'll want a background audio track. Or you'll see a lot of games, for example, there's a very popular game out there that I'm sure some of the listeners are familiar with called Clash of Clans. It's on the iPhone and Android. And Clash of Clans, the publisher who produced that game, was very smart in that the game inherently, automatically generates a video replay of every time you play it. And so it made it very easy for people to share those videos up on YouTube or elsewhere. And those videos, you're seeing millions of uploads a week of those gameplay videos with an audio track behind it.
Wow. Well, that's very cool. Didn't you tell me that the future of gaming and music is going to be the ability for a user to actually assign his own soundtrack?
either from his library or just from a number of selections?
Sure. And, you know, I remember the first time you and I talked about this, go all the way back to one of the very first Xbox games called Project Gotham Racing, where you were in your, you know, video game rendered car, and you could change the radio stations. And the radio stations were, in that particular game's case, pre-programmed or stored tracks of popular radio stations around the country. So when you were racing through New York, you could listen to recorded versions of New York radio stations. Now, of course, all the rights were cleared on the songs, and they paid the DJs whose voices they used on the radio station to record the tracks and such. But it gave the player a degree of selection of what kind of audio track they wanted to have playing while they were racing around the game. And, you know, you also had other, a lot of the big PC games have had for a number of years the ability for you to tell the game about a folder on your hard drive full of MP3s, and you wanted that to be your background track while you were playing the game. It was very personal. What we're seeing now is the melding of the two, where tools like Spotify and Pandora, with their APIs, have connected to the video game community and letting people play their Spotify tracks within a video game. And that's more interesting to me, because now we have a full complete circle around the data, and a particular artist can know what games their fans are playing or what kind of interests their fans have beyond just their own music.
Yeah, it's a lot more exciting for an artist, that's for sure. If you're a music publisher, or I'm sorry, if you're a video game publisher, is there kind of like a standard rate for licensing music, or is it on a per game basis or a per situation basis?
There are industry rates that have, you know, were negotiated by, you know, a lot of the unions and ASCAP and the guilds and such years ago. But the reality set in pretty quickly that game production budgets are across the entire spectrum. I mean, you look at the game production budget of something like a Call of Duty, Ghosts, or a Battlefield, or the new Titanfall. You know, you're talking about game production budgets in the tens upon tens of millions of dollars, and correspondingly, their music licensing budgets are much, much higher, and they can do more interesting things. At the other end of the spectrum, you've got small publishers. One of them who went public today, King.com, who is known for their game Candy Crush.
Yeah.
But you've got these smaller publishers, and the game production budgets there may only be $250,000 all in. I know at Atari, we were producing games in the $60,000 to $100,000 range to get a game into the market. So your production budgets for music tend to be much, much smaller, which is much more exciting, I think, given this connection we're now seeing where a small publisher can reach out to aspiring musicians, and there's the establishment of a marketplace, so to speak, out there to find out, well, who wants to have their music included in the game, and I'll be happy to share revenue with them as we go.
What's the ratio of the section of the music or a section of the budget that's applied to music? Is it like 10% or 1% or 5%? Is there a standard?
Yeah, on a big what we call AAA title, again, that's the Titanfalls and the Halos and the Call of Duties, you'll see anywhere from 5 to 10% on audio, which would include not only the licensing but the audio engineering for the game. There's occasionally you'll have a game where the designers are really into the audio, and I would say you look at something like the BioShock series in terms of AAA titles. While they didn't use any commercial music in their game, the audio engineering was a much larger budget because of the environment they're trying to create, the soundscape they wanted to have the game evoke. Whereas on a smaller mobile game or even a web-delivered social game, the budget may be, it's certainly going to be less than 5%.
Well, this has been very cool, Tom. Very enlightening as always. Every time I talk to you, I learn not one thing, but lots. So, and even though we've talked about a lot of this stuff before, I still learn things from you, and that's why I'm always happy to speak with you.
So it's always a pleasure, Bobby.
Thank you again for doing this, and we'll speak very soon, I hope.
Looking forward to it. Thanks again, Bobby.
Thanks very much.
Thanks so much, Tom. That was great, and I hope all of you understand a little bit more about making money from YouTube, because you really can make some dough, although, as you've seen, it does take a little bit of an effort to do it. It's not quite as cut and dried as we'd all like. If you want to find out more about Omnia Media, go to omniamedia.co. That's Omnia, O-M-N-I-A, Media, M-E-D-I-A. It's all one word, .co. And you can see what they do, and you can see some of their clients as well. So thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby O's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or just go right to bobbyoinnercircle.com. At my website at bobbyosinski.com, you'll find links to blogs and coaching programs, as well as a sign-up sheet for my newsletter, and you can read some other stuff, like excerpts from my books and some free chapters and things like that. So this is Bobby Osinski. See you next time.